Well, it's that season again, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
The season, some say the season, tis the season, I've heard this before, tis the season for all heathen. don't say that out too loud. Some people might not understand where you're coming from with it. But, we understand, of course, that there are certain accoutrements of Christmas, certain things associated with it. Word drawn from pagan cultures, and this happened actually through the centuries, and many different cultures contributed to it. So we're all familiar with Christmas, and we also understand that it is, in actual fact, in this country, it is a secular holiday. Even though there are those voices out there among evangelicals and Catholics and perhaps others who are saying, let's put Christ back into Christmas, and they want to make it more of a religious observance, and you hear sentiments to that effect all the time. But in reality, it is a secular holiday. It doesn't mean, it doesn't have, for most people, I don't think they're thinking about the message of the Bible. For example, if you go out to your neighbor's yards and look around at the decorations and everything, I have one neighbor, I mean, I can't believe what all they have in their yard. They've got these blown up, these things you blow up, you know, the giant Christmas trees and Santa Claus and reindeer and all kinds of things. Nothing about Jesus there, but it doesn't matter with me one way or the other. But it's very clearly a secular holiday. And it's all about giving gifts and, you know, doing good business during that time for the various stores, the various department stores and what have you. So that's what it's all about, basically. So it does not have as much a religious message for most people anymore. Perhaps at one time it did. But there's another holiday at this time of the year. Another holiday that also, among the people who observe it, it doesn't have very much in the way of the meaning that it originally had. Do you know what holiday I'm talking about? Hanukkah. You know, today I would dare say that many of the Jews who observe Hanukkah, that many of them couldn't tell you its origin. They're not concerned about it. They could probably sing the little jingle, little song that Adam Sandler came up with. You remember that one? Put on your yarmulke, here comes Hanukkah. Smoke a little marijuana, all that stuff. All that stuff he came up with. They probably know that, but as far as the actual history of Hanukkah, they probably don't do it, don't know it. And many, I would say, do not know that they know that that's a Jewish holiday. They put it in the same category with the Leviticus 23 festivals and holy days, which those are God's festivals and holy days. Those are commanded. They're a part of the Torah, part of the law. But certainly Hanukkah was not. It was something that came about, began to be observed in the intertestamental period, the 2nd century B.C. And a lot of people, again, a lot of people look at it today and said, oh, well, look, you know, it's about lighting candles, light overcoming darkness and love and joy and all those wonderful things and giving one another gifts. In other words, it's Christmas for Jews. So that's basically what it has come to be for many people. But let's go back. I'd like to go back to the book of Daniel. We'll begin there. And take a look at this, and take a look at the origins of Hanukkah. We'll make our way to it in a little while. But let's first of all go back to Daniel, and let's begin along about chapter 8. A little bit of a recap of things we've covered in the past. You remember in Daniel 2, we had the dream image of Nebuchadnezzar. You understand what that means. The various body parts symbolize the different empires, beginning with the Neo-Babylonian Empire, followed by the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Greco-Macedonian Empire, and finally the Roman Empire, represented by the two legs. And then you see the same thing in Daniel 7. You see the four beasts. Again, the same succession of empires, from Neo-Babylonian Empire down to the Roman Empire. But then Daniel focuses, the prophecies he's given, the visions he receives, focus on one in particular. It's not the Roman Empire. the last one. It's not the first one, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. It's not even the second one, even though it's mentioned here. The Persian, the Medo-Persians, it is the Grecian kingdom. That's the one he focuses on. And so beginning in chapter 8, let's notice this vision. Let's read a little about it, maybe read through the whole thing here, and I'll explain as I go. This would have been in about 550 to 51 B.C., because it says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I was in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I saw Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Euleah. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. This represents the Medo-Persian Empire. The greater horn, the one that came up higher than the other, was, of course, the Persians. But the Medes were involved as well. So I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And, of course, it was in the Persian period that the people, the Jews in the Babylonian captivity, were released and went back to the land, back to what is now called Palestine, back to Judea, back to the promised land. So there you have this picture of the second of the seven, or the second of the four empires depicted in the other visions of Daniel. The second one, the Medo-Persian kingdom. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. This is the Grecian kingdom. The notable horn is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him. So I've got a little blurry spot here on the page. Attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there no one could deliver the ram from his hand. So this was the campaign of Alexander the Great. Of course, this, you might describe it as his sort of a blitzkrieg style of warfare, and this pretty well describes it here. He's well known for that, and he conquered this kingdom. Then it goes on to say about, it tells us about something else that happened here. And this is why there's so much emphasis on the Grecian kingdom. We're coming to that. And you're going to see in chapter 11 that he really focuses on the details. Because these are things that would come to pass in the 2nd century B.C. in great detail here. This is why so many scholars believe that this part of the book of Daniel was written in the 2nd century B.C. because they say, how in the world could he have known about all of these things that he lived back in the time of Nebuchadnezzar? So they say, well, he must have been there to witness and know about these different events. But he gives great detail in the reign, concerning the reign of the Syrian kings, and we'll see about that in just a few minutes. But let's continue here. Verse 8, therefore the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in its place four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. In other words, Alexander the Great died fairly young. Different stories on how that happened, but nevertheless, he's out of the picture now, and he was the great leader. But now then, in his place, these four generals came up. They carved up his kingdom into four. And those four generals were Seleucus, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy. Now, you may recognize a couple of those names in particular. Seleucus, the Seleucid the Seleucid kingdom with the Syrian kings. That's the king, what is described elsewhere as the king of the north. Ptolemy, associated with Egypt. That's the king of the south. So you have the Ptolemaic kingdom and you have the Seleucid kingdom. These are the ones that kind of stand out here. And you're going to see Daniel, through these visions, focus on those two, particularly, especially the Seleucid kingdom. And remember, these were all Greeks. It goes on to say, goes on to tell us, in verse 9, and out of one of them, that's one of those four horns, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land, that's Judea. In other words, he's going to have this little horn, whoever this is going to have some kind of tremendous effect upon the people living in Judea. And indeed, as we shall see, he did. Verse 10, and it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host of some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. This is just another way of saying that he did enter the glorious land and he did wreak havoc there. He killed a lot of the people. And who we're talking about here specifically is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. Says he even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. In other words, he basically considered himself to be God. Epiphanes, God in the flesh, that's what he means. You know, an embodied form of God or a God of some sort. But exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. You know, this is the guy who put a statue of Zeus in the temple and offered swine's flesh on the altar. And you can imagine what kind of response he got out of the people for that. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifice, and he cast truth down to the ground. He destroyed copies of Scripture as he found them. And also he forbade Jewish practice. He did all of this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will it be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to the trampled, to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Now, this probably means 2,000. There's controversy on what the meaning of this is, because literally the text reads 2,300 evening mornings. So do you count the evening and mornings? One evening, one morning, is that the number that comes out to 2,300? Or do you count those each evening and morning as a day, therefore come up with 1,150 days? In any case, we do know when this came about, when the sanctuary was cleansed, meaning it was rededicated. And that was in 164 B.C., after a very important, historically speaking, a very important Jewish revolt against the Syrian leadership. So there you have that. That's an overview there. But I'd like to go and take a look a little more detail into chapter 11. We'll skip over a lot of material to get to chapter 11. And even here, we'll skip through and just to mention in passing that this speaks in depth of the Syrian kings of the Seleucid dynasty. It gives quite a bit of detail about those. The first portion there of this of Daniel 11 gives you, well, I'll put it this way, from Daniel down about verse 6, that's when you begin reading about the Seleucid kings and their exploits, and you begin to read, and let's see, from down about verse 10 onward to verse 19, you read about Antiochus the Third, who's also known as Antiochus the Great. He's the father of Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. But Antiochus the Third, you begin reading about him beginning in verse 10, and his relationship with Ptolemy, that's the king of the south. So you have the king of the north and the king of the south. And it talks about the contention and the relationship between them and what happened between them. And you can go to any good commentary that will give you an analysis of each verse here. We're not going to do it today, but you can see that some historical details are referred to here. A period of history there between, and the what happened between the king of the north and king of the south, or between Antiochus the Third and the Ptolemies. I guess it was Ptolemy the Fifth, who was in Egypt at that time. But in about to summarize quite a bit here, in about 200 BC is when Antiochus the Third defeated Ptolemy the Fifth, and now. Before, previous to this, the Holy Land, Palestine as it's now called, or Judea, was under the control of the Ptolemaic kingdom from Egypt. But now, when Antiochus III defeated Ptolemy, then now it's under the control of Antiochus III, the king of the north. And Antiochus III promised the Jewish people there that they could continue unabated with their religious practice. They could continue sacrificing at the temple. They could go right on and do whatever they did, and they had complete freedom to do that. And of course, that's always a good thing. That was always good news to them when they had a foreign power, which was most of the time, dominating them. So here was Antiochus III, also known as Antiochus the Great, giving them, the Jews, religious freedom in Judea to carry on their religious practice as they saw fit. And the Romans later would do much the same thing until things went sour in that relationship. Well, let's take up the account here, just a few verses in verse 19 to cut across a lot of historical detail. Verse 19 is actually referring to Antiochus III. Says, then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, and he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So this is at the end of his reign. And then verse 20 refers to an individual called Seleucus, however you wish to pronounce that, Seleucus Philippator. Says, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, and not in anger or in battle. So he didn't last long at all. And he was immediately succeeded by another. And here he comes. Here comes the little horn. It's in verse 21. This is Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. And in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. So wait a minute, I want to be king, it's my turn. Oh no, we don't want you to be king. But he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So he took it anyway. With the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Now what is this referring to? You look at that, almost sounds messianic, but no, I don't think it is. In one sense it could be. In typological sense, but this is almost certainly referring to the high priest Onias the Third, who was assassinated by the henchmen of Antiochus the Fourth. Now, why was that so? What was going on here? Let me give you a little bit of the backdrop historically. What was happening that resulted in this assassination, and what was it that angered Antiochus so much toward the Jews? Well, you had among the Jews themselves somewhat of a civil war going on. You could call it a war. It's a civil strife going on. You had those who were the pro-Hellenistic Jews. So, we like to be Greekified. You know, we still worship the God of our fathers, but we like that Greek, all that Greek culture stuff going on as well. So you had these Hellenized Jews. The traditionalists, on the other hand, said, whoa, wait a minute. You know what happens when we start incorporating foreign concepts and ideas and practices into our religious practice. What happened to the fathers? They got driven out of this land. You want that to happen again? Don't want that to happen. We must be faithful to the covenant. We must be faithful to the Torah. We must worship God according to His instructions and hold those traditions that have been handed down to us. So you had those two factions. And at one point, even the Hellenistic Jews, many of them were even exiled. But they got the ear of Antiochus IV, and they convinced him, and there's controversy on exactly how all these things happened, but nevertheless, there's differences of opinion among scholars. But in any case, he sided with them, and he did eventually do what they wanted him to do, and that is take control in a very strong way of Judea. And he did. And what he began to do then, he began to give dictates concerning religious practice. And he's the one that eventually did burn swine's flesh on the altar. He desecrated the temple so terribly, he put the statue of Zeus in the temple. And he did all kinds of terrible things. And he was he really had it in for the Jews. So let's go ahead and read what it says here. At least those traditionalist Jews. And he forbade their regular religious practice. Things like the Sabbath, circumcision, all the things that they were accustomed to, the things they did. He said, it's forbidden now. You can't do those things anymore. So he was involved, or at least his henchmen were involved, in the assassination of Onias. Onias was a pro-Ptolemaic kingdom person. He preferred to have the Ptolemies in charge, but not these other guys. And he was one of the traditionalists. He opposed the Hellenistic party. So continuing, says, and after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plan against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, and he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. But these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, and he shall do damage and return to his own land. It goes on to describe the blasphemies of the king of the north, and we won't go through all of this, but again, we know the things that he did. We know his exploits and the horrendous things he did there in Judea. And ultimately, he comes to a very bad end. And what happened there, what happened was, there was a Jewish revolt. It had been going on for some time, involving several leading Jews. I think, as I recall, they were priests. And they continued to fight against this oppressive power. And eventually, there came a new leader among them. His name was Judah, also known as Judas. And he was also called Maccabeus. You've heard of the Maccabean Revolt. This was it. This was what this led to. The Maccabean Revolt. And it goes on to tell us about, we won't read all that. I want to turn to another source here. Another old book. If you have a copy of it with you, then turn with me to 2 Maccabees. If you brought your Catholic Bible, turn with me to 2 Maccabees, chapter 8. Actually, this is not a Catholic Bible. This is the New Revised Standard Version I bought a good many years back, and it has the Apocrypha with it. That's also known as the Deuterocanonical text. I do not believe that this is a part of Scripture, of inspired Scripture, but I do believe that these books, many of them, do provide some good insight into the historical period and tell us something about it, even though most scholars would agree that some of this is probably not 100% accurate. Nevertheless, you get an idea of what Antiochus the Great, Antiochus the Fourth was like. You also get an idea as to what Judas, also known as Maccabeus, it says, was like, and what was going on there. So I'd like to read a little portion of this, and let's see. We'll start in chapter 8, and in leading up to this, it tells about this terrible thing going on under the reign of Antiochus the Fourth, and the martyrdoms that were taking place, and other bad things he was doing, about the revolt that took place, and then it starts talking about this individual named Judas, Judas Maccabees or Maccabeus. It says in chapter 8, first verse, "Meanwhile Judas, who was also called Maccabeus, and his companions secretly entered the villages and summoned their kindred and enlisted those who had continued in the Jewish faith, and so they gathered about 6,000. They implored the Lord to look upon the people who were oppressed by all and to have pity on the temple that had been profaned by the godless, to have mercy on the city that was being destroyed and about to be leveled to the ground, to hearken to the blood that cried out to him, to remember also the lawless destruction of the innocent babies and blasphemies committed against his name, and to show his hatred of evil. As soon as Maccabeus got his army organized, the Gentiles could not withstand him, for the wrath of the Lord had turned to mercy. Coming without warning, he would set fire to towns and villages. He captured strategic positions and put to flight not a few of the enemy. He found the nights most advantageous for such attacks, and talk of his valor spread everywhere." So he became quite famous because he was leading a successful campaign against the Seleucids, against Antiochus the Fourth and his forces. And so he was gaining a reputation. And then it goes on to say that when Philip, this was of Macedon, the king of Macedon, when Philip saw that the man was gaining ground little by little and that he was pushing ahead with more frequent successes, he wrote to Ptolemy, the governor of Coelesyria and Phoenicia, to come to the aid of the king's government. Then Ptolemy promptly appointed Nicanor, son of Patroclus, Patroclus, I don't know how to pronounce some of these names, Patroclus, one of the king's chief friends, and sent him in command of no fewer than 20,000 Gentiles of all nations to wipe out the whole race of Judea. So they meant business. They wanted to put a stop to this Judas Maccabees and his renegade forces that were beginning to have a lot of success in opposing their oppressors. So he associated with him Gorgias, a general and a man of experience in military service. Nicanor determined to make up the king the tribute due to the Romans, 2,000 talents. So he's going to go out there and do the king a real good deed. This is what he's going to do here. It says, by selling the captured Jews into slavery. So he immediately sent to the towns on the seacoast, inviting them to buy Jewish slaves and promising to hand over 90 slaves for a talent, not expecting the judgment from the Almighty that was about to overtake him. In other words, it didn't work. It didn't work out. Judas, to sum up this longer story here, Judas successfully defeated Nicanor. He defeated him in battle, and that's, again, this is getting the attention. This is getting the attention of the Syrians. And then also it goes on to tell about how Judas defeats Timothy and Bacchides, two others who are in league with Antiochus. And then we turn our attention to Antiochus the Fourth. And we understand, of course, he eventually did come to a very bitter end. But let's notice how it happened, at least according to 2 Maccabees. In chapter 9, it says, "About that time, as it happened, Antiochus had returned in disorder from the region of Persia. He had entered the city called Persepolis and attempted to rob the temples and control the city. Therefore, the people rushed to the rescue with arms, and Antiochus on his army and his army were defeated. So he's elsewhere now, and he suffers a defeat. But then when he hears about things going on, that makes it, that's really, really rubbing salt into the wound. With the result that Antiochus was put to flight by the inhabitants and beat a shameful retreat. So he had to get out from there. While he was in Ecbatana, news came to him of what had happened to Nicanor and the forces of Timothy. In other words, what Judas had done, Judas and his armies, the Maccabean revolt, what they had done, how they had defeated them. Transported with rage, he conceived the idea of turning upon the Jews the injury done by those who had put him to flight. So he ordered his charioteer to drive without stopping until he completed the journey. So he was going to say, you go toward Jerusalem, do not stop. And this is what he had in plan, what he had in store for them. It says, of course, but the judgment of heaven rode with him. So there was something else at work here. For in his arrogance, he said, when I get there, I will make Jerusalem a cemetery of Jews. So he was going to wipe them out. Deal with the Jewish problem once and for all. We've heard that before, haven't we? But the all-seeing Lord, the God of Israel, struck him with an incurable and invisible blow. As soon as he stopped speaking, he was seized with a pain in his bowels, for which there was no relief, and with sharp internal tortures, and that very justly, for he had tortured the bowels of others with many and strange inflictions. Yet he did not in any way stop his insolence, but was even more filled with arrogance, breathing fire in his rage against the Jews, and giving orders to drive even faster. And so it came about that he fell out of his chariot as it was rushing along, and the fall was so hard as to torture every limb of his body. So this poor guy is really beat up at this point. Thus, he who only a little while before had thought in his superhuman arrogance that he could command the waves of the sea and had imagined that he could weigh the high mountains in balance was brought down to earth and carried in a litter, making the power of God manifest to all. And so the ungodly man's body swarmed with worms, and while he was still living in anguish and pain, his flesh rotted away, and because of the stench, the whole army felt revulsion at the decay. Because of his intolerable stench, no one was able to carry the man who a little while before had thought that he could touch the stars of heaven. He's in a bad way right now. Then it was that, broken in spirit, he began to lose much of his arrogance. Yeah, he kind of humbles himself now. You know what he did? He got to the place in all his suffering, and you know the fact that none of his men could get around him because the stench, and the fact that he'd never imagined being in such a condition. So he decided he'd start making promises to God. I'll undo all the bad things that I've done. I won't do the bad things I said I would do, but I'll undo the bad that I have already done, and I'll repair the things that I've broken down, and give the Jews their freedom of worship. So and I'll even, if you'll just deliver from me from this, Lord, I'll become a Jew. God still said no. No, it's too. You've gone too far with this one. And then he decides he's going to write this letter, try to sort of make up for some things. So it's recorded here. It says, to this worthy, this is Antiochus, to his worthy Jewish citizens, Antiochus, their king and general, sends hearty greetings and good wishes for their health and prosperity. This is a guy that's going to go kill them all. If you and your children are well and your affairs are as you wish, I am glad, as my hope is in heaven. I remember with affection your esteem and goodwill, and on it goes. So you see what's going on there, don't you? But it's a little bit late for this fellow, and he does die a miserable death. Now, we'll skip on over some material here, and we're going to see what happened after this. And now you can put on your yarmulke, because here comes Hanukkah. In chapter 10, skipping on down to chapter 10, it says, "Now Maccabeus and his followers, the Lord leading them on, recovered the temple and the city. They tore down the altars that had been built in the public square by the foreigners, and also destroyed the sacred precincts. They purified the sanctuary and made another altar of sacrifice. Then, striking fire out of flint, they offered sacrifices after a lapse of 2 years, and they offered incense and lighted lamps and set out the bread of presence." Now understand that Judas himself was a priest, and some of the other men who worked with him, fought with him, were also priests. "When they had done this, they fell prostrate and implored the Lord that they might never again fall into such misfortunes, but that if they should ever sin, they might be disciplined by him with forbearance and not be handed over to blasphemous and barbarous nations. It happened that on that same day on which the sanctuary had been profaned by the foreigners, the purification of the sanctuary took place, that is, on the 25th day of the same month, which is Kislev." So we're in that period now. "They celebrated it for 8 days." There's your Hanukkah right there. "With rejoicing in the manner of the festival of booths, remembering how not long before, during the festival of booths, they had been wandering in the mountains and caves like wild animals." They're under oppression. "Therefore, carrying ivy-wreathed wands and beautiful branches and also fronds of palm, they offered hymns of thanksgiving to him who had given success to the purifying of his own holy place. They decreed by public edict, ratified by vote, that the whole nation of the Jews should observe these days every year. Such then was the end of Antiochus, who was called Epiphanes." So this is the origin here. This is the original story. Now you have some things associated with Hanukkah that we don't know about. Jewish tradition says that why did they have this? Have all this lighting of the candles, have the 8 days, and they say, well, what happened there? This is Jewish tradition. And I don't think there's any evidence that this existed until sometime later, after the actual event. So people dispute as to whether or not this is true, whether an actual miracle took place. But apparently to light the menorah, you needed a certain amount of oil. They only had enough for 1 day. And they lit it, but it burned 8 days anyway. That's the story. Whether that's true or not, whether that's an actual miracle, who knows? But most think it's something that was added later. In any case, there you have the earliest origin. That's the original Hanukkah. Put it that way, without some of the other things that were added later. And it's not something that we should be compelled to do, because this is not part of the annual holy days or festivals that are commanded in Leviticus 23, but this is a part of Jewish history, and you can understand, just as we have our July the 4th, and France has Bastille Day, and other nations have their particular days commemorating events in their history, so the Jewish people have this, even though I suspect, as I said earlier, that a good many of them don't have any idea as to the story behind it. So there you have it. Now, what about then the New Testament? When you come to the New Testament, is there any reference to this at all? Well, go to John the 10th chapter, John chapter 10, and yes, indeed, you do find something here. John 10, verse 22. "Now it was the feast of dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter." Yeah, it was Kislev. Kislev 25 is when the Feast of Dedication began. This is the same thing as Hanukkah. This is what it's talking about here. So this practice, this custom of celebrating this, and it never was considered on an equal par with the other, the festivals and holy days of Leviticus 23. But here you find it was being celebrated, it was being observed in memory of those events, very important events in their own history. It says, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. So you have Jesus here apparently celebrating with other Jews the Feast of Dedication. But again, I suspect it looked very differently then than it does today. The Feast of Dedication. So there it is. Now, what is when you can really break it down, you think about it, what is the Feast of Dedication really all about? Well, we understand they dedicated the temple after it had been, after Antiochus had desecrated it and all the terrible things he did, and depriving them of their religious practices and, you know, forbidding their religious practices. It's all about this restoration and rededication of the temple and restoring the worship of God in the land. That's what it's really about. But the underlying principle there is what? You know what it's about is salvation, because God delivered the people in the time of a very vile king, in the time of heavy persecution, heavy oppression. A lot of people were dying as a result of this man's misleadership. And so it's a time of salvation, a time when God himself intervened and cut that man's life short and gave success to the Maccabeans, to the Jews who were brave enough to stand up against it. So it's about salvation. It's about deliverance from bondage, isn't it? Because they were put under oppression. They were in bondage. And they were delivered from it. It's also about, as we said, restoration of true worship. So all of those things are contained within this Feast of Dedication, or Yarmulke. I'm sorry, Hanukkah. I'm about to go with the Adam Sandler jingle again. But that's what it's really about. Now, I'd like to, since it is about really the rededication of the temple according to the divinely ordained patterns of worship, you know, the patterns of worship and the laws, the statutes and so on concerned with the temple, the priesthood and so on, their attempt was to get that back as it was supposed to be. So rededicate the temple and restore the worship of God. I'd like to go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 6 and see something here. When the temple, the original temple, was originally dedicated, and it was during the reign of Solomon. And I think we can see something here. We begin to see something that we can develop theologically. And I think we'll begin to see that even in this text here, that there is an underlying theme that has rich Christological significance. Here we read about it. This is when the temple was, Solomon built the temple. The ark was brought into the temple. And then you have Solomon's prayer of dedication, beginning in, I think, about verse 12. And let's drop on down there a little bit. And says, verse 17, it says, and that now, O Lord God of Israel, let your word come true, which you have spoken to your servant David. Solomon, of course, was the son of David. Therefore, a type of Messiah. But will God indeed dwell with men on earth? Now, this is what's in Solomon's mind at the time. And there's a very important truth found here. Will God indeed dwell with men on the earth? What is he getting at here? What is the point of this temple anyway? What was it for? It was to replace the tabernacle that they carried with them in the wilderness, this movable tabernacle. And wherever wherever God indicated, they would set the tabernacle up, and that's where God placed his name. And then the glory of God would descend upon it, and God was dwelling in the tabernacle. In other words, you have the encampment of Israel in the wilderness, and in the midst you have the tabernacle. In other words, God himself dwelt in the midst of Israel. That was the message. That was the point. He was in their midst. And the point of the temple is that now God has this permanent dwelling It's not movable any longer. It's now a temple. And he has this dwelling, and he will dwell among his people. He will dwell there. But Solomon has some questions going through his mind as he dedicates the temple for that purpose. It says, "But will God indeed dwell with men on the earth? Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain you." He's not talking about how physically big God is. Of course not. He just looks up at the starry skies at night. He sees that it was God. He knows it was God who stretched the star, that stretched the heavens above the earth. And of course, today, with our knowledge, scientific knowledge, we know a lot of things Solomon couldn't have known. We know something about galaxies and perhaps the size of the universe based on the number of galaxies and how far apart these massive things are out there. There's so many massive bodies, including the galaxies. How many light years? In other words, 186,000 miles per second. How many years you'd have to travel at that speed to get from one point to another point inside one galaxy, let alone the perhaps millions or billions of others that are there. So we know more about that now. We think, this God created all of that. And so you can understand Solomon's thought here. You mean to tell me that in this little speck called planet Earth, this one little tiny little place out here in this remote part of one of these many, many galaxies, that I built a box here, a house, is basically what is a house compared to all that? And God is going to get in there. He's going to dwell here. Really? So you understand where Solomon is coming from, don't you? But you know what the truth of the matter here is? It says, as he says, "Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain you." Well, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. It cannot. It cannot. And therefore, our minds cannot contain him either. He can be God who dwells in heaven, in the heaven of heavens, and also dwells in the temple. So he says, "The heaven of heavens cannot contain you. How much less this temple that I have built?" And nevertheless, we know that God does. Now, you start to look at some other scriptures. We've done this in the past. I'm not going to review them all, so I'll just mention them in passing. You remember when God met Abraham? He showed up at his tent one day with a couple of angels. He seems to have recognized him. The text calls him Yahweh. He says Yahweh was there. He was conversing with Abraham. He even ate with him. So what does it tell you? This God, Elohim, whom the heaven of heavens cannot contain, can actually appear on earth in bodily form. And yet, later on, remember the story? When he went ahead and destroyed Sodom after explaining to Abraham what he's going to do? Remember what it says? And Yahweh, apparently Yahweh on earth, this embodied Yahweh on earth, calls down fire from Yahweh out of heaven. What does that tell you? It tells you something. There's some kind of... That God is more than just a man, doesn't it? We've looked at the word Elohim in the past, and there's this lot of debate over the meaning of that, but what we do know about it, the word is translated God, we do know that the suffix is plural. But we also know at the same time that when you use that same word in a sentence and using singular verbs, you understand in a singular sense. But then what that tells us is that there's some sense that there's some kind of plurality there, and yet Elohim is still, in some sense, singular. One Elohim. And I think perhaps one way you can kind of begin to get your mind around it, not an exact analogy, but God made one humanity, only one humanity. He didn't put a humanity over here in the Garden of Eden, another humanity over there, another humanity. No, one humanity, one humanity. And yet this one humanity is in some sense plural, isn't it? Because there's a lot of us, a lot of us. So this Elohim, God, is in some sense plural. The text doesn't clearly define how, but it does. We do know from the term itself that there's some sense of plurality there. And yet put it this way, there's plurality in the unity. Just as there's plurality in the unity of humanity. So there's plurality in the unity of Elohim or God. So God can be in heaven, the manifestation in heaven, if you want to call it a manifestation. As Solomon says, heaven of heavens cannot contain you. And yet, embodied on earth. So you have the foundation there for a good, rich, high Christology. What I mean by high Christology, the scholars speak in terms, theologians speak in terms of high versus low Christology. And what that means, if you're studying Christ, the doctrine of Christ, from the point of view of his deity, then that's called high Christology. If you're studying Christ from the point of view of his humanity, both being true, but humanity, that's called a low Christology. So this has what we see here, God dwelling in the midst of his people, the God whom heaven cannot contain, yet is actually there. And also we know this, that when he appeared to Moses, he appeared in bodily form. He can be in heaven, and yet God is on earth bodily. So God in heaven, heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, on earth bodily. So you get that. You see that here. He is actually in the temple, and yet the temple can't contain God, all there is of God. So you see what the makings here for a rich and high Christology. Now, I'd like to go, with that in mind, I'd like to go to what I consider to be one of the strongest, most profound texts on high Christology, on the deity of Christ, in the New Testament. And we'll go to John 1, but that's not the one I have in mind. This one to me is, I hate to say one scripture being more important than another, but just from my perspective, as I examine this subject, this one kind of stands out. I'll put it that way. And it's in Colossians, the book of Colossians. And it's verse 9. But let's get this in context, back up a little bit there. It says, beware, verse 8, lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the traditions of men, according to the basic principles of the world, or the elements of the world, and not according to Christ. Now stop there. What was it? Who were these people, and what were they promising? The people who are troubling the Colossian Christians. Well, they were actually asceticists, and their attempt, they were showing you how you could experience the fullness of God, okay? This is how you can experience the fullness of God. It's through the practice of asceticism. They had some other mystical stuff mixed in there with it, worship of angels and things like that. Who knows what other elements of philosophy, whether Greek or otherwise. But in any case, this is what they were teaching. They were showing people how to experience the fullness of God. And it was through these man-made traditions. And Paul is saying, don't be deceived by any of this. But listen, this is what he says. He says, again, verse 8, beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles or elements of the world, and not according to Christ. For in him, not in these elements of the world, not in these man-made traditions of asceticism, but in him dwells all the fullness of the deity bodily. So the fullness of deity dwells in him bodily. This doesn't mean simply that he has a divine nature of some sort, or that divine, some kind of divinity has rested upon him. No, it dwells in him, in Jesus. In Jesus we see the deity bodily, in bodily form. That's what he's telling us here. This is God in the flesh, not God the Father. We understand that. But nevertheless, deity having taken human flesh. So you have this, what theologians call the hypostatic union of divinity with humanity. The one in the one person of Christ. So here, rather than finding the fullness of God in ascetic practice, we find the fullness of God in the person of Jesus. And he goes on, the point he's making is, it is our being joined to him. You see, we become a part of his body, as it were, the spiritual body, which is the church. by being joined intimately in that way to Him, then we experience God in a far more powerful way. It's not through the practice of asceticism. But the point I'm getting at here is that deity dwells in the full, in the fullness of deity dwells bodily in Him. So you have deity and humanity right there in the one Christ. And of course, we know Christ prayed to His Father in heaven. So there again, you see the same thing. Heaven of heavens cannot contain you, and yet you can appear here on earth in bodily form. So you have some kind of plurality here in Elohim, in God. Now, with that in mind, let's go back to John 1, and we'll finish this shortly here. Gone a little longer, I think, than expected, but nevertheless, John 1, in verse 1, we'll skip over some of it to save time, but John 1, in the beginning, was the Word. The term is logos in the Greek, and the Word was with tantheon, literally, with the God, because the definite article is in the Greek. The Word was with tantheon, with, let's put it a different way, it makes it a little easier on our ears, was with the deity. And the Word was deity. You see what he's saying? He's saying the Logos was with the deity, as in face to face with the deity, figuratively speaking, of course, with the deity, and yet the Word was deity. Now, some people want to say, wait a minute, this is not the way it appears in the Greek. In the Greek, it says, and God was the Word, or Theos was the Word. Well, so what? Yeah, okay, the same thing, isn't it? So my question is this, is the Word deity or not? Yes, it is. It says so right here. I was going to read the whole thing down to verse 14, but let's skip over that. Go right to verse 14. And the Word, now, what have we said about the Word? Was this something other than deity? Or is it deity? Okay. The Word became flesh. And I've asked that question to some Unitarians. I said, okay, are you saying that the Word is in no sense God? I can't get an answer. I start explaining around. I said, okay, but if we take the text, what it says the Word is God, or God is the Word, if you want to follow the Greek order. You know, the reason all English translators put it this way, rather than God is the Word, you know why they do that? I asked one person that one time. He said, "Oh, it's a deception. It's to try to hide the truth." No. It's because the Word is the subject. God is not the subject. The Word is the subject. So, in speaking English, we normally put the subject first, don't we? The Word was with God. We don't say, "And God was the Word." No, we say, "And the Word," that's the subject, "was God." I think the New English Translation captures the meaning here. It may seem a little ambiguous if you read this literally from the Greek, but I think it captures the meaning, and that is the Word was with God, and what God was, the Word was. That's what the meaning here is. So again, is the Word in some sense God? If I believe what it says there in verse 1, I have to say yes. Then it says in verse 14, the Word, that would have to be God in some sense, wouldn't it? The Word became flesh, and guess what happened? And dwelt among us, tabernacled among us. Now, no question about it, if you read through John 1, he's drawing from the creation narrative and applying it to Christ. But also, in this case here, I believe, undoubtedly, he's drawing from the temple or tabernacle narrative from the Old Testament and how God dwelt in the midst of his people in the temple or in the tabernacle, actually there among them. And what this is saying is God dwelt with it or dwells with his people through this embodied Word. God is with us through Christ. Therefore, when we are joined to Christ, we have that relationship that the children of Israel had only in type, even though God dwelt in their midst. But now we have the fullness of that relationship because the Word was made flesh and tabernacled among us. So I believe if you want to get a message out of Hanukkah, the rededication of the temple, restoration of the worship of Yahweh, meaning Yahweh dwelling in the midst of his people with fully restored worship, then here you have the real story right here. So, you know, I don't observe Hanukkah, never have. Don't think I ever will. There's nothing wrong with it. I don't have anything against it. I know some people who do. But I also know some people who kind of have found a replacement of Christmas in Hanukkah. So they go ahead and feel okay about observing Hanukkah. I don't see any point, any reason to observe it. But since it is that time of year, and you hear the messages and commercials on TV, you know, not only Merry Christmas, some of them are actually saying that now, or Happy Holidays, but also references to Hanukkah from time to time, as well as a string of other holidays that different people celebrate. So that's the story of the Feast of Dedication. And again, I think the real message there is the message that we see in the construction and dedication of the temple itself, with God's original design for it and his intent to dwell among his people. And you know, the time will come, even though we have that relationship now in Christ, but the time will come when Jesus Christ will deliver the kingdom up to God the Father, and the Father himself will literally tabernacle among us as he makes his home on planet Earth. This little planet, the little speck out in the universe, will become central, the center, the headquarters, as it were, of the universe. For God himself will dwell with his people right here on planet Earth.